The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Ah, yes. Good afternoon. Great to have you along with us here on the Guy James Show this afternoon at about, 1 minute and 10 seconds after the hour of 3 o'clock Eastern Time. It's after the hour anywhere you are, unless, as we were discussing the other day, in Newfoundland and Afghanistan and one other country, can't think what it is, that's on the half hour. Ah, more mindless trivia that you don't need. We are glad to have you along with us this afternoon. We've got a lot to talk about today. First of all, let me tell you, we're going to have a fellow on this afternoon that I think is going to be one of the best interviews you've ever heard. And you may have seen him on TV, Dr. Justin Frank. You don't know who Dr. Justin Frank is, you say? Well, he's a psychiatric doctor in Washington, and he's the gentleman that wrote the book Inside the Mind of the President. And I think he's got old Georgie boy pegged exactly right, and I think you're going to really enjoy hearing what he has to say about his book and Inside the Mind of the President and some other questions that we'll be wanting to ask him this afternoon. You can call us, 866-546-5254, 866-546-5254. We'd love to hear from you today. We'd love for you to call in and ask Dr. Frank any questions you may have about his book when we have him on. He's going to be on either late in this hour or early in the next hour. We don't know which for exactly yet. But we're awfully glad to have you along. We're going to have a good show for you today. We're in a situation here in the studio today where where Ryan isn't here, and so we've got our stand-in producer in with us today, and she's over there. My wife Bess is the assistant producer. Are you already over there?
Yes, I am.
You
yes,
are.
I am, Guy.
Okay, so you got all the buttons to push and all that. You think
I'll
you can do
my best?
You can. Okay. Yeah. I mean, like when the phone rings. We won't be end up crossing wires with somebody
in
Kurdistan or something.
No.
Okay. All right. Okay. Good enough. I know you all saw the news today. A lot of news. Andy Card is fleeing the White House. What do you think about that? Is this another one of those situations where it's rats off a sinking ship? I kind of think so. I think you're going to see some more of it as well. And we have news coming down that Fitzgerald is seeking new White House indictments. Oh, my. Oh, my. Who will it be? Who will it be? I got a story. I ripped it off. Where did I get this story? Truthout.org. In lengthy interviews over the weekend and on Monday, they said that Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald had started to prepare the paperwork to present to the grand jury seeking an indictment against White House Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove or, oh, God, let it be so, or National Security Advisor Stephen Hanley. What do you think? It said, although the situation remains fluid, it's possible these sources say that Fitzgerald may seek to indict both Rove and Hanley, charging them with perjury, obstruction of justice, and conspiracy-related crimes, pertaining to their roles in the leak of Plame's Wilson idea and their identity and their efforts to cover up their involvement following a Justice Department investigation. The sources said late Monday that it may take more than a month before Fitzgerald presents the paperwork outlining the government's case against one or both of the officials and asks the grand jury to return an indictment because he is currently juggling quite a few high-profile criminal cases and will need to carve out time to write the indictment and prepare the evidence. Well, Patrick Fitzgerald, if you need any help typing this thing up or writing it up, I know several people that would volunteer to help, so you won't have to wait a month. But it's going to be interesting to see how that all shakes out. It really is. You know, Karl Rove and friends in the White House, it's time. I believe it's really the time has come for the good people of the United States of America to demand accountability from their elected leaders. And I believe it's time for those of us who love this country and what it stands for to say enough is enough. You've seen all the shenanigans that have gone on in this administration. One scandal after another, after another, after another. Taking the law in their own hands, breaking the law at will. And if you revere the, you know, if you revere the Constitution and the rule of law, you need to finally say to yourselves that the time's come to demand the removal of George W. Bush, Richard Cheney, Rumsfeld, Karl Rove, Condoleezza Rice, literally everyone who signed on to this administration's policy of lying and propagandizing the American citizens. It's time to remove them from their positions of power and turn the government over to someone who has the best interest of the United States in mind, instead of wanting nothing more than to make the White House the seat of unlimited power with which to dominate the rest of the branches of government for the sole purpose of enriching those who put them in office, and themselves, of course. Now, why have I taken this new direction? I kind of remain a little bit neutral on this subject. You know, I realize that ridding ourselves of these terribly deceitful, dreadful, this vile group of people will cause temporary pain for our nation. It will. Of course it will. They'll fight their removal with their last breath. You know they will. They'll seek to further divide our nation. They'll pull every propaganda stunt in the book. And they'll behave as desperate rats having been cornered. It's to be expected of people like this to put their self-interest ahead of the well-being of our country. They always have, and they always will. But do you ask, Guy, why have I now become so passionate about throwing these people out of their positions? It's simple, really. I never trusted any of them. I don't hate them, but I never trusted them to work for the good of America. Not from the get-go. But now that it's come to light in the last couple of days, you know, the last nail in the coffin that Bush and Cheney had planned from even before being sworn into office to go to war against Iraq, that's the last straw for me. Now that there's incontrovertible proof that everything they ever said about Iraq was a lie. Proof. Not conjecture. Actual proof that from day one of Bush's administration, he planned to take us to war. Now that all that is on the table, it's time for him to go. Think of all the lies that have been told by him, Cheney and the others, and they continue on with these outrageous lies. Think about last week. Just last week, when the right-wing press and media went after Helen Thomas for asking Bush a question. You know, he feigned righteous indignation to the press corps after Helen asked him about his reasoning to go to war. Oh no, Helen, I didn't want to go to war. That was the last thing I wanted to do. It was the final option after exhausting all other avenues. Oh, I would never send our young men and women into battle unless there was no other choice. Is this man the perfect example of a pathological liar or what? Imagine standing in front of the American public and telling a lie like that when he knows damn well there's documentation floating around someplace that it's a fat lie. And you know why he does that? Because he knows he can get away with it. Well, I think the time's come when he won't get away with it anymore. This war is an ugly debacle for us and for the Iraqis. It was never going to be any different. Our credibility with the world is down the drain, and it's got to be stated that I mean our credibility, because it was the people of the United States of America who cast their ballots to have this man continue on after 4 years of horrendous leadership. After 4 years of a disastrous term, the people of America willingly put him back into office. We can't claim to the rest of the world anymore, well, you may not trust our government, but you can trust us. Oh, no. We, the people, have lost our credibility in the world community, because it's quite obvious that half of the people of this nation wanted this evil dictatorship to continue and give them 4 more years to finish the job of destroying the goodwill of our nation that we'd built up over the last couple of centuries. So they're they're Mr. Hotshot on national security like hell. Our military is being destroyed by this Bush administration. The morale of our fighting forces has been terribly adversely affected. Recruitment's down. Who will want to join the military in the future if they know that some wannabe despot like Bush will send him into battle for some unfounded reason or some selfish reason of his own? Over 2,000 of our finest young men and women have been killed. Over 2,300, actually. Thousands more have been maimed for life. Untold thousands of Iraqis have been needlessly slaughtered. For what? For what? For nothing more than to satisfy the egomaniacal lust for power that's so pervasive in this Bush administration. We've engaged in torture. The United States of America involved in torture sanctioned and condoned by our government. I know that by now most of you have read the Manning memo from Great Britain. It's shocking. And moreover, no one has denied the veracity of these documents. They're an indictment of the Bush administration and absolute incontrovertible proof that Bush has engaged in a massive propaganda campaign against the citizens of this country, the likes of which has never been seen before in this country. Never. I think Chris Matthews put an exclamation point on the whole Manning affair when he told us last evening that former Defense Secretary Cohen told him that right after the Supreme Court appointed Bush to be our king, even before he took the oath of office, Cheney called Cohen and demanded a briefing. Not a briefing on the entire world as it pertained to our military. Not an overall picture of the state of the military. Oh, no. Oh, no. This evil bastard Cheney demanded a briefing about Iraq and Iraq alone. That says it all. That pretty well sums the whole thing up. They were hell-bent upon going to war from even before they raised their right hands and swore to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, so help them God. The Constitution to them is nothing more than a roll of toilet paper in their bathrooms. That's what it means to these people, because they've crapped on it. There's no question of that. This should serve notice to all of those people who voted him in because Bush was a godly man. That there is nothing godly whatsoever about this administration. Nothing. There have been other cases of presidents lying to the American public, propagandizing the people is nothing new. Many administrations have engaged in it. We can't do anything about that now. That's in the past. But what we can do is remove this gang of wicked to the core people from the seats of power in Washington. It'll be difficult, it'll be painful, and it will be messy. But if we give them their just rewards by throwing them out in utter disgrace, we'll be serving notice on future would-be American tyrants that we, the people, will not stand for having leaders who don't exemplify what is inherently good and decent about this country. Now's the time to forget about your party affiliation. I swear before you and I swear before my God that if this was Bill Clinton, I approved of his presidency. I didn't approve of his moral character in some issues. But if this was Bill Clinton, as well as his administration went, if he had done this to us, I'd be asking for him to be thrown out of office. Now's the time to forget the political squabbling. Do what's right for America. Get a hold of your congressman, get a hold of your senator, and demand the removal of the Bush administration. Demand them. This is our government. Yours. Mine. Your neighbors. That's who it is. Doesn't belong just to the people in the seats of power in Washington, D.C. They work for us, or at least they're supposed to. That's the way it started out. Of the people, by the people, and for the people. Can't you just see Cheney and Bush and Rummy sitting around the table and in the White House having a cigar and maybe a drink in one hand and just having a big laugh over that? Of the people, these people, they don't know anything. We can pull the wool over their eyes, and we have anytime we want to. I find Cheney and Rumsfeld particularly detestable. I've never seen two men in government that I detested more than Cheney and Rumsfeld. To be honest with you, it's hard for me to feel exactly that way about Bush. I think he's just a willing dupe, a willing pawn in this whole thing. Dumb enough to allow these people to take him over and do their bidding. Oh, I've got the power of the presidency of the United States. That's all I want. We'll do whatever you guys want, but as long as I'm the dictator. Remember when he said that? Dictatorship wouldn't be so bad as long as I'm the dictator. I think these boys took that seriously. I think they took it very seriously. But now is the time for the people to rise up and take it back. It's time. We can't have this apathy anymore. So, my friends, if you're a Republican, if you're an independent, if you're a Democrat, now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of their country. Absolutely. We need to throw these people out of office. We can't take another couple years of it. We just can't. 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back in just a minute.
She come back, I kind of doubt it. I feel so lonesome, I'm gonna sing about it. Ain't got no money to win or lose. All I've got are the lonesome banjo blues. No turf or coal for the kitchen fire. Damp and cold, it might even snow. But I've got an easy chair, and I've got a banjo. Sit by the mirror, we'll play as a duo. Sit by the mirror, we'll play as a duo. Or Paraguay, but I got a world atlas, and now I'm far away. I think of my granddad, I think of my brothers, I think when my daddy tucked us under the covers. I had a relation, it took a while to create it. Life was too easy, I had to complicate it. Now I've got this picture, and I've got a banjo. Sit by the mirror, we'll play as a trio. Sit by the mirror, we'll play as a trio.
Back with you. Glad to have you along with us this afternoon in the Guy James Show. We've got a great interview coming up with Dr. Justin Frank. It's going to be, I'm told now, just slightly after 4 o'clock, right in that neighborhood. I'm supposed to, if I'm supposed to be a smart radio guy, I'm not supposed to say that. I'm supposed to say, coming up soon, or, shortly. and then drag you on for another hour and a half. That's how they do it, but I won't do that. You know me better than that. I don't believe in that. You know, I like to find great quotes. Some of them are fabulous, and I found one today that just dovetails with what I just said. A little rant of mine I started off the show with today. I feel passionately about it. And about whether we'll throw these people out of office. And there are people going to call you an extremist for wanting to do that. And I found this wonderful quote by Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. And I quote, "The question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremist we will be. The nation and the world are in dire need of creative extremists." Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Truer words were never spoken. We need people to stand up right now and save this country from these people. And I don't care who it is. You know me well enough by now that I'm not going to give you any BS. I want to serve notice. And I, you know, I talked about partisanship in this a few minutes ago. I don't care whether you're a liberal, a conservative, or an independent. I don't care. I want to make it very clear that I'm going to serve notice to those who want the Democratic nomination for president and to those in the House and Senate running for re-election. I cannot, I will not, I swear I will not back any candidate who doesn't demand that we leave Iraq on the next available bus. If you were taken in by the Bush administration lies which took us into the war, I will forgive you. I will, my candidates, I will forgive you. People make mistakes. I wasn't taken in by those lies, and in fact, many of us here knew they were lies, and we warned you that they were lies. However, if you were taken in, I will forgive you. But I will not. I will not. I will never forgive you for continuing on in the support of this immoral, illegal war. Therefore, if you voted for the war but now realize and admit it was a horrible mistake, I can support you. But if you voted for the war and still don't admit that we need to be getting the hell out of there as soon as possible, then I will not only not support you, I will actively work against you, no matter who you are. Are you listening, Hillary? Now's the time to make your stance known on this. No more waffling on this issue. This is the most important issue facing our country today. We've got a lot of important issues. We've got health care. We've got national security. We've got our educational problems, the immigration problems, a lot of problems. But we are getting our young men and women killed on the battlefield every single day. And we sit here and we take it. We cannot have Democrat candidates running for office who support this man's war. I don't know of a better way to show these people that we mean business than to let every one of our Democratic candidates and office holders know right now that we will no longer support a single one of them. Not one. I don't care who they are if they continue to support this war. Makes no difference to me. This is a moral issue. Very much a moral issue. Besides the practical end of it of bankrupting our treasury and getting 2,300 and some odd of our finest young men and women killed. Besides having our national security more endangered now than it was before 9/11. Besides having our credibility around the world being trashed. This is important. It's important for our nation. And we've got to get the message out. We simply must. 866-546-5254 is the number. I hope you'll give us a call if you've got a comment or question on what we have to say. How many of you read the British memos and the path to war? How many of you saw them? Let me tell you some interesting reading. Bush It definitely proves Bush was determined to invade Iraq, even if no weapons of mass destruction were found. It says during a private two-hour meeting in the Oval Office on January 31st, 2003, Bush made it clear to Prime Minister Tony Blair of Britain that he was determined to invade Iraq without the second resolution, or even if international arms inspector failed to find unconventional weapons. Our diplomatic strategy had to be arranged around the military planning, David Manning, Mr. Blair's chief foreign advisor at the time, wrote in the memo that summarized the discussion between Bush and Blair and six of their top aides. The start date for the military campaign was now penciled in for the 10th of March. This is when the bombing would begin. Now, if that weren't enough, Bush mentioned three... You want to find out what a scheming, lying, no-good rat this guy is? Bush mentioned three ways to provoke a confrontation with Iraq. The January 2003 memo by David Manning also said the president raised three possible ways of provoking a confrontation with Iraq. Get this. The U.S. was thinking of flying U-2 reconnaissance aircraft with fighter cover over Iraq, painted in UN colors. The memo says, attributing the idea to Mr. Bush, so if Saddam fired on him, he would be in breach. It also described the president as saying the U.S. might be able to bring out a defector who could give a public presentation about Saddam's WMDs, referring to the weapons of mass destruction that we all now know now didn't exist. Have you noticed how these people lately, to go off on a side issue here, have you noticed these people in the last few days, the Newsmax people and the Freepers and all the wild radical right-wingers are all saying why they did find those weapons of mass destruction? And we've got proof, we've got documents from Saddam. That's floating around on the internet, I know that. I've seen it, you've seen it, lots of us have seen it. Ah yes, they've got these documents that prove there were WMDs. Let me tell you something. If there was a definitive answer that would satisfy the Bush administration and whether or not they had WMDs in Iraq, Bush himself would be standing out in front of the White House with papers in his hand going, extra, extra, read all about it. We've got your WMDs right now, and I was right all along. Don't you think they would be doing that? Of course they would. They wouldn't be able to get to the TV studios fast enough to declare how right they were. Don't you think they'd all breathe a sigh of relief in the background? Even though they knew we didn't go to war for that in the first place, they'd say, at least we can keep this lie going. We can justify this now. We can tell the poor suckers that voted for us, see, you were right. We deserved your trust because we told you there were WMDs over there, and they never thought there was. But if you're suckered in by that argument, if you're suckered in by the argument that these people have the documentation that's floating around on the internet right now that they've found WMDs, you don't have to go any farther than the White House to know that's a damn lie. Who has more to gain than them? They're not saying it, are they? No. But they were trying to provoke old Saddam, painting a plain white in UN colors and getting him to fire on it. And then they were going to get a defector to come out and talk about Saddam's WMDs. And of course, they were thinking about a third possibility mentioned by Mr. Bush, a proposal to assassinate Saddam Hussein. Sure would have saved a lot of trouble, wouldn't it? I'm not saying I back that. I'm not saying we ought to be in the business of assassinating world leaders of other countries because it puts our own chief executive in the sights. That's what I don't like about it. But, during the meeting that the memos were about, Bush dismissed the idea of war between the different religious and ethnic groups in Iraq. It says there was a discussion of what might happen in Iraq after Saddam had been overthrown, and President Bush said that he thought, now get this, Bush said he thought it unlikely that there would be internecine warfare between the different religious and ethnic groups. If he didn't think there would be, why didn't he ask somebody that knows about the situation? You know, we had Eric Margolis on the program yesterday, a world-renowned foreign correspondent that knows that issue. You know, he pretty much says that everybody that has any knowledge of that area whatsoever, everybody, knows there was going to be trouble between the Sunnis and the Shias. Everybody. But Bush said he thought it wasn't likely that there'd be the warfare between the different religious and ethnic groups. How stupid do you have to be? Or how blind? So, in the memo, Bush said military action was going to take place regardless of whether a second UN resolution was passed. Now, isn't that something? He goes on the world stage and he has all these people out here saying, well, you know, we're going to the UN. We're going to the UN because people were complaining. The Democrats were saying, well, you know, they got to go to the UN over this. So they were saying, well, we are going to the UN. Meanwhile, in the background, they're saying, I don't give a damn what the UN says. We'll tell these schmucks that want us to go to the UN that we'll go to the UN, but we don't give a rat's patoot what the UN says because we are going to war. I don't care what they say. You know, the memo goes on to say at several points during the meeting between Bush and Blair, there was palpable tension over finding a legitimate legal trigger for going to war that would be acceptable to the other nations. Now, there wasn't tension on whether we ought to go to war or not. There wasn't tension over the fact that there would be a civil war started in that country. There wasn't tension over the fact that we would turn terrorists loose all over the world, attract them to that place. We'd be breeding terrorists like mad. There wasn't any tension over that. Oh, no. The tension was over whether or not we'd find an acceptable way to con the people into going along with going into war. That's what the tension was about. You know, the memo says the prime minister was quoted as saying it was essential for both countries to lobby for a second United Nations resolution against Iraq. Mr. Bush agreed that the two countries should attempt to get a second resolution, but he added that time was running out. The U.S. would put its full weight behind efforts to get the document added, but he had to say that if we ultimately failed, military action would follow anyway. Despite the intense lobbying by the United States and Britain, the second United Nations resolution was not obtained. But they didn't care. They did not care. I know, this is, we'll talk a lot about this memo today. I found it downright disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. 866-546-5254. We're going to go to the phone right now, and we've got Peter in the capital of Florida, Tallahassee. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Guy. How are you today?
Well, I'm all bent out of shape today. I really am.
Yeah, I am too. It started out this morning with the Truth Out news alerts that come into your inbox. And I tell you, it's just getting more and more evil by the minute.
Yeah.
The scandal is just, it's outrageous. If you just never know where to turn. This whole Bush presidency has gone from an American tragedy to a worldwide tragedy. And what really, really upsets me, Guy, is the lack of discernment in the population in general. You know, you remember when Martin Luther King was shot? You know, that was such a traumatic thing. You know, people tend to remember exactly where they were and what they were doing when it happened.
Absolutely.
And when Kennedy was assassinated and when the Challenger blew up, people tend to, those strong memories tend to associate themselves. Well, the very day that the Supreme Court in the 2000 elections, ruled that the votes were not going to be counted in Florida, not recounted, mind you. They weren't going to be counted to begin with. I remember exactly where I was when that decision came out. I remember exactly the chair I was sitting in, and I remember exactly what I did. I hung my head, and I said out loud, God help. And, you know, it just amazes me to this day that there is no discernment in in the population in general to have seen that evil? Why can't people see it, Guy?
Well, you know, Peter, it fascinates me. You're exactly right. You're exactly right. You know, you thought that. I thought that. I figured we were in for a rough ride, a terribly rough ride. But people were just willing to, you know, as far as stealing the election, there were so many people in those days, in those sad, sad days of that long December that we spent looking at the Chads and all that. There were so many people that said, oh, they wouldn't do that. Oh, these are good people. They're godly people. They wouldn't steal an election. Well, what do they think now?
Yes, and now we know that it was Bolton himself who was leading the pack, pounding on the doors, going, stop the vote, stop the vote.
Absolutely. We got the picture to prove it.
Yes.
Bolton and his whole gang behind him there beating on the doors. Yes, my God.
Yes, but it's just gotten to the point that that things have got to change quickly. And there's so much discussion about the voting machines, and of course, that's very important. You know, we're dealing with a voting system that is completely controlled by a private organization, and we've talked about that to the point that just about everybody knows about it. But, you know, the media, too, is so complicit in all of this. You know, day after day, you can switch between the ABC, CBS, NBC evening news. They will be covering exactly the same stories with exactly the same spin on exactly the same day. Now, Guy, how does that happen? How does three entirely different organizations, you know, it's just so obvious that this is all coordinated from a very high level.
I will never, ever, ever again trust an election with these voting machines. I can't. I would never rest my head on a pillow at night after voting and know that it was fair.
Yes, sir. And here in Florida, we've outlawed counting the from the optical scanners. You know that it kicks out the paper, but we've outlawed counting those by hand.
Yes. It's just a rotten shame. I mean, there are other countries in this world. I realize there's a lot of people in this country, and I realize the American people are the most impatient people in the world, and they can't wait to get the results. But I will wait a couple of days. I will wait a week. I will wait till hell freezes over to get an honest count. You know, this deal of having to have it now, that doesn't mean anything to me.
No, of course it's meaningless. And someone was pointing out the other day that, in fact, you would know the results immediately because of the exit polls. Every election in the world, you know, you get accurate exit polls, at least enough to predict the winner, unless it's down to the wire.
You're exactly right, Peter. And there is no way that any thinking people could look at the results of the Ohio election the last time and not know that those exit polls were spot on. The historical accuracy of them was right there, and yet we know what happened.
Yes, we certainly do. There was one little news tidbit I wanted to share with you. You won't hear this kind of news just anywhere. It's always carefully suppressed. But you know the hostage. He was a member of the Christian Peacemakers who was being held over in Iraq, and he was, you know, they were threatening to kill him. And or was it Iran? No, it was Iraq.
Right.
And he's just been released. And you know, the churches were praying for him. Anyways, his name is James Lonnie. He's Canadian. Well, anyway, the co-director of the Christian Peacemakers team, who I guess would be his boss, or at least one of the heads of the organization, has now said that the man is gay. And his family was in fear that that he would come to definitely come to harm at the hands of the Iraqis if they had known that. You know, there's a huge crackdown over there, with anyone who is gay. You know, his family was very, very concerned about his mother and father were very concerned about it getting out that he was. And his partner's name is Dan Hunt, couldn't go forward with a plea for his release. In any case, you know, he's home now, and thank God for that. But I just wanted, you know, the lurkers that you have on your show, the little right-wing idiots, I just wanted to know that he was a gay man. I think that that's just important to know is a by the way.
Oh, I think you must be mistaken, Peter. Certainly, people that mirror a democracy such as ours, and that's what we're planting over there. We're wanting to plant a mirror of our democracy in the Middle East. Surely they wouldn't discriminate against a gay. Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Yeah, I don't know what I was thinking. Yeah, we. That's right.
Yes, you think?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
I don't know. I don't know what's in store for us. I really don't. You know, I'm disgusted. I see. Bushes. they don't run out. There's got an endless supplies of rats. Now he's turning to Grover Norquist. To help shore up his low ratings now. Grover is so proud of that. He said, I've been in the White House more in the last 2 weeks than I was in the last 2 years. And, I can't believe anybody would call Grover Norquist in as an advisor, especially a president, but he's doing it there. Do you think they realize how much trouble they're in?
Well, they do, but they can't change the team. I mean, Grover Norquist, they're just substituting another Bolton for what's-his-face.
Yeah.
Just resigned this morning. But, you know, it's the same people. They're all part of the same team. They're just substituting different faces. There's really no change happening.
No. And they're not going to change. I think that we were foolish if we thought they would. He's done the stay the course enough now that I believe that no matter what, he will stay the course. He's that type of a man. He would never admit a mistake. Never.
No, he can't. He's, as they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, constitutionally incapable of being honest with himself.
Yeah, well, we're going to have a gentleman on the next hour, and I hope you'll stick around here at Dr. Justin Frank.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
He's going
to... While I'm here, I want to invite everybody over to the chat room. It's headonradionetwork.com, and once you get there, just click on chat room, And we're following you along in the show. And, yes, I'm certainly looking forward to the interview. I think that's great.
Well, then tell us about the chat room a little bit, Peter. You have to register to go in?
Well, you do. The registration is simply so that the handle or the name that you choose when you're in the chat room remains registered to you so that, you know, someone else doesn't come back and take your name by accident, or so that you every time you log in, you'll be able to go in as the same person.
Well, I wanted to make that known because let everybody know they're not going to get requests for magazine subscriptions sent to their home, and they're not going to get 50 people calling on the phone asking to give you a home loan, right?
Oh, Lord, no. There's no pop-ups, no invitations for it's not a... the sort of chat room that's public in the sense that it's like a Yahoo chat room or something, and we're just using it. It's actually it's actually owned and controlled by the Head On Radio Network, so it's entirely us, and we'd love to see you drop in. It only takes a second to register,
Everybody do. The more the merrier. It's all put up there by our good friend Bob Kincaid up in Beckley, West Virginia.
Yeah,
and Bob. Bob has been a great help to our show when we were building our new studio. Why we went to him for technical advice, and he was kind enough to lend his voice to whatever we ask him about, and we appreciate that so very much.
Yes, Bob is certainly a diamond. I we enjoy him tremendously.
Yeah. Hey, Peter, thanks for calling today.
Thank you.
Appreciate hearing from you.
Later. Yes, sir. Bye.
Yeah, Peter from Tallahassee. Well, that's that's a place you could use some shaking up as well, up in Tallahassee, Florida. Our beloved Jebster, Mr. Jeb Bush, and, of course, his brother Neil is in cahoots here in Florida with this, the FCAT thing and the educational tools. Neil's got a healthy stake in the financial interest in the state of Florida in the educational system. And it's really getting better, you know. I don't know how many of you are aware of it. I don't know, and I don't want to shock anybody, but with the Jebster being ranked as such a great governor here in Florida, you know, and all he's done for education here in Florida, and we're all the way up to 49th now. That's right. We got Mississippi beat, not by much, but we got them. So we can be proud of Mr. Jeb Bush and the FCAT test. See, our kids here in Florida, I don't know about where you're at, but our kids here in Florida anymore, they don't study to learn things anymore. They study to memorize a test. Yeah, the teachers are pretty much bound by law now that they've got to, and I'm not going to make a big thing of this today, but the teachers have got to teach these kids how to take this test, and that, by and large, is what the kids learn in school, try and memorize the test. They're not being taught how to think anymore. Oh, no, we wouldn't want to do that. And in the great state of Florida, if your kid goes to a school that's ranked a little less than average, they'll give you vouchers. And you can take those vouchers right on to a private school, a for-profit school. You see, public education is something the neocons would love to do away with. Imagine that. Here I go again off on a tangent, but imagine that. Doing away with public education, which is exactly what they're after. Make no mistake about it. They want to put education in the hands of private schools altogether. So all the schools are going to be for-profit schools. Isn't that just peachy? You know, one of the worst schools in the area where we're lived here, where we live, one of the worst schools rated, private school. But for profit. And guess who's going to be getting the profit? I wonder. 866-546-5254. Give us a call. If you'd like to discuss the issues of the day, we were talking a little earlier about the Manning memo and kind of giving you a little synopsis of the whole thing. In March of 2002, Bush had yet to find the answers to the big questions about the war. David Manning wrote about a meeting that he had with Condi Rice. He reported, this is just unbelievable, it really is, he reported that Bush has yet to find the answers to the big question, how to persuade international opinion that military action against Iraq is necessary and justified, and what value to put on the exiled Iraqi opposition. We know most of Shalabi and all them turned out to be the best of liars. I don't know how good a liar, I shouldn't say that. I don't know how good a liars they were, but they sure pulled the wool over the Pentagon and the State Department in Bush's eyes. There's no question about that. And they hadn't figured out how to coordinate a U.S. and allied military campaign with an internal opposition, assuming that there was any. And they hadn't figured out what happens the morning after. You know, the British, in this whole thing, they warned of a real risk that Bush was underestimating the difficulties. And in that memo to Blair, Manning wrote, Bush wants to hear your views on Iraq before taking decisions, making decisions. This gives you real influence, he's telling Blair, that he can have influence over Bush. He goes on to say, I think there's a real risk that the administration underestimates the difficulties. Oh, man. Give that guy a stuffed monkey. He wins the prize on that one. You bet he underestimated the difficulties. He went on to say, they may agree that failure isn't an option, but this does not mean that they will avoid it. Well, we're getting our feet wet with failure right now. There isn't any question about it. Oh, wait a minute. No, there was all good news over there this past week, wasn't it? That's right. I'm sorry. I forgot for a moment. I forgot. They're painting the schools and stuff. Yeah. And about 30 or 40% of the people actually have drinking water. What could I have been thinking? There's all that progress. And they're getting better at getting dead bodies off the streets. Have you noticed the efficiency with which they're able to do that now in Baghdad? You get 30 or 40 people died. You know, a year or two ago, they weren't so good at it. But now they get the streets cleaned up right away. They got a truck that comes in, bang, zoom, throw those dead bodies in the truck and haul them off so the American cameras don't get a good look at it. Trouble is, enough of us have had a look at it. Trouble is, people with a mind people with compassion for their fellow man have seen those pictures of the children. The children with their legs blown off. Expectant mothers laying dead in the back of a truck. Oh, yes. In many cases, in most all the cases, it was terrorist bombs that did that. But why were those terrorist bombs going off there? Why? They weren't going off before, but they are now. And the picture of all that doesn't seem to bother enough people in this country. It doesn't seem to, well, that's war, you know. That's war. Bad things happen in war. It sure as hell does. It happens to women and to children, completely innocent people. But hey, that's just collateral damage. That's all it is. People die in war. Even some of our own people die in war. Somebody's got to sacrifice to keep us free. That's what they're telling us. Glorious war. Bush's war. So very glorious. Now, if you go over there and get your ass blown to kingdom come, we'll mention what a noble thing that is, our Bush administration, but we won't show a picture of your casket coming back into Dover, Delaware. I'll tell you that right now. Isn't anybody going to see a picture of your flag-draped casket coming back? But we respect it, okay? We honor you. We honor you. Like so much cannon fodder. I'm in a mood today. I'm in a foul mood concerning this Bush administration. I feel worse about them than I have in these past 5 years. It's all been building and building and building until I can't begin to tell you the terrible, terrible disappointment I feel toward the people in this country that put that man back into office. It's one of those things that can't be explained properly to me. I'll never understand it. If you voted for Bush, you've got to live with it. And you don't like hearing me say that, a lot of you that voted for Bush, and I know you're listening. I hear from you. I know you hate it when I say that, because you don't like being wrong. Jeez, none of us like being wrong about anything. We all got our pride and our vanity and all that, and we don't want to be wrong about things. We don't want to look stupid about things. We don't. It's human nature. We all want to be winners. We all want to know everything and be right all the time and all that. And that's all well and good. But I'll tell you one thing. The mark of a real man, the mark of a real woman, is when you can make a mistake and you can stand before your peers and say, you know what, I was wrong. I was wrong and I'm sorry. I'm sorry my mistake help cause the lives of 2,300 soldiers. I'm sorry. I apologize. I was wrong. And you don't have to do that. I don't expect everybody that voted for Bush to call up and say, I'm sorry that I voted for. I don't expect that. But I do expect you to listen to the facts. I do expect you to be a little more careful when you listen to what these neocons say from now on. I do expect you to learn a lesson from all of this. I know I have. This is not a group of people that can be trusted. They've proven that over and over and over again, that they cannot be trusted about anything. I can't think of anything that they should be trusted about. They have squandered the good faith of the American people. Oh, yes, this is a partisan country when it comes to politics. I'm guilty. I'm a partisan Democrat. I'll tell you that right now, and I pretty much vote a straight ticket because I know anybody that's a real Democrat will do the right thing. But there's more to it than that now. It's more than just a little bit of partisan squabbling that we used to do. You've heard me say before that I'm so sad that political talk in this country has come to what it has. It used to be a friendly thing with your neighbor. I like to tell the story of my neighbor down the road when I was a kid. There'd be an election, particularly one I'm thinking of, John Kennedy. The night John Kennedy got elected, and it was the wee hours of the morning before we found out that he had won indeed. I remember my father going down middle of the night, 4 o'clock in the morning, taking that bottle of whiskey that he'd had bet. I bet a bottle of fine whiskey. Went down there. Come on, boys, let's go down there. We go down and knock on the door. Hey, Fred, guess what? You owe me a bottle of whiskey. Never ever saw my dad drink that whiskey, but he was happy to take it from Fred. And they'd talk about it for a while, shake hands, and that was that. You might hear a word or two now and then about, oh, I don't think your guy's doing a good job, or I didn't like this or didn't like that, but there wasn't the rancor that there is today. I hope, and I see no evidence that there was the deceitfulness that there is today, not on this level at least. I know now and then there are probably some things, and I hate to say it, there are probably some things that might be better off kept secret from the public. It better be an extreme case. But the effort with which this administration has put out the secrecy and hid behind this cloak of darkness that they love, this Cheney and his secrecy, it's amazing to me. It's amazing to me that anybody could follow these people ever again and ever believe another word they say. I don't get it. 866-546-5254. You're welcome to call us. We're going to have a great guest coming up at the just after the top of the hour, a minute or so after the top of the hour. We're going to have Dr. Justin Frank. And let me tell you, if you've never heard Dr. Justin Frank talk about his book, Inside the Mind of a President, it's called Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of a President, you've got to hear this guy. You got to hear this guy. He's got a list of qualifications a mile long. This is no quack. This is no fly-by-nighter decided to write a book. This is a man who is highly esteemed in his field. And you would do well to call your neighbor and tell him to log on right now and listen to this, because it's going to be very, very interesting. I hope that I can come up with good enough questions to pull everything out of this man that I'd like to hear from him, because he's truly a very, very fascinating man. So we're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll have that interview in short order for you. Don't go away. You're listening to The Guy James Show.
Take the side of freedom, know your enemy. It ain't hard to do, they speak on our TV. They own the radio, they own the magazine. As they make the world sick with their disease. Well, they're selling promises to the working man, who's signing contracts that he don't understand. They got him tied down, working overtime, hoping that the ends will meet somewhere down the line. Somewhere down the line, we're gonna have to make a stand. Our drain's gonna wash away the blood upon the land. Where the tears are falling now, a raging sea will flow. Singing the most perfect song the world did ever know. Please. policeman still arresting anyone who's making noise. Enjoy your freedom, but just don't raise your voice. Live your life in silence, work till you're 65. Always chasing dreams that you will never realize. You're working for the dollar that they'll just take away and line their pockets with the money that you save. As the market crumbles, they're still getting fat. Go watch a movie and forget about that. Our drain's gonna wash away the blood upon the land. Where the tears are falling down, raging sea will flow. Singing the most perfect song the world did ever know. Singing the most perfect song the world did ever know.
Your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Yes, indeed. Guy James here with you this afternoon. So glad to have all of you along with us. And I promised you a great interview this afternoon. And I want to tell you just I want to take a moment and to tell you about the gentleman that's going to be with us. Justin Frank, MD, is an expert in the field of psychoanalysis. He's a clinician with more than 30 years' experience. Dr. Frank has also been a former columnist for Salon Magazine, and he's a frequent writer on topics as diverse as politics, film, and theater. He is a co-director of the Metropolitan Center for Object Relations in New York, a clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at George Washington University Medical Center, and a teaching analyst at the Washington Psychoanalytic Institute. Dr. Frank used the principles of applied psychoanalysis to assemble a comprehensive psychological profile of President George W. Bush in his book, Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President. Dr. Frank did his psychiatric residency at Harvard Medical School and was chief resident at the Cambridge Hospital. Dr. Frank was also awarded the DuPont Warren Fellowship by Massachusetts General Hospital. Wow. He lives in Washington, D.C., where he teaches and practices psychoanalysis. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Justin Frank. So glad to have you along with us this afternoon, Dr. Frank.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We told everybody all about you and your most impressive biography here. You live in Washington, right?
Yes, I live in Washington. Been living here for over 30 years.
You're right in the seat of power there, so you have a better chance than most of us to take a look at what goes on here.
Yeah, living here is a peculiar combination of being in the seat of power and at the same time being powerless because we don't have any representation. That's just a plug for D.C. statehood.
Yes, indeed. I've always believed in D.C. statehood. Clearly, your book has generated a real buzz in the political arena. What kind of reaction have you personally received so far?
Well, personally, I've received a lot of very positive reaction from both my colleagues and from the press and from some political people. The most positive or most interesting one, I guess, has been that Senator Kerry used some of the ideas in the book for his first debate, which I thought was quite interesting.
You couldn't get a much better compliment than that.
Well, Yeah, that was good. In fact, he had it on his kitchen table, supposedly, from a friend of mine, I was told later.
Oh, great.
At his house for the whole time. But I think he stopped using it after the first debate, which was a problem for him. It was his problem.
Yes.
But as far as reaction goes, there's been reaction from all over that's been pretty positive. I think the most negative reaction, however, has been from people who haven't read the book, and that includes both political commentators as well as colleagues in my field. The psychiatrists who read the book were quite positive about it. And I certainly consulted with quite a few psychoanalysts before I sent it to publication.
Could you give us a brief description of what it was that you were trying to accomplish with your book?
Well, I was trying to, as a psychoanalyst, which I've been in practice for many years, I've always tried to understand how people get to be the way they are. And that includes both looking at their history, looking at patterns of behavior, but it also includes a careful examination of the here and now in terms of the way they are, what their defenses are, how they function, how they think and work. And I think that one of the things that I wanted to accomplish was doing that same thing with President Bush, because I had been quite concerned and really frightened fairly early on in his presidency that he was different from any other president we've ever had, even those I've disagreed with politically in the past. There have been plenty. In that there was something peculiar about him. Right from the days of the campaign in 2000, a couple of things I noticed that were really disturbing, and I wanted to look further. And after 9/11, it became more and more necessary to do that for me personally. There's the things that in particular that I noticed was his inability to take responsibility for anything he did. There was no sense of personal accountability for anything he did. I was also struck by his tendency for black and white thinking. And then watching him on television, there was a quality in his eyes that looked like he was constantly frightened and anxious in a way that I've never seen in another president. Those things combined with his history of heavy alcohol abuse and his sort of secrecy and his the smirk I noticed in the second Gore debate, all of those things combined to set off alarm bells. And he reminded me of quite a few of my patients who have had alcoholic family members, particularly alcoholic fathers, and also who had been alcoholics who were untreated. So I was concerned about him from the beginning. There's a tradition in psychoanalysis called applied psychoanalysis, which is the CIA does, actually, which was started by Freud, where you apply psychoanalytic thinking to historical figures, because there's no way to really see him in my consulting room. Of course, then I wouldn't be able to write about it either.
Well, yes, and I know you've stated that you never met with the president. So what methods have you used to come up with an analysis of someone you've not directly examined? I mean, I know Freud has made psychological observations of famous people without actually meeting them, but how accurate are those observations, and
well,
what are
shocking.
What?
They're surprisingly accurate. I think that, in fact, they're so accurate that Roosevelt commissioned a couple of psychoanalysts to study Hitler in around 1940 or 42, I guess. One of those studies is in the Hyde Park Library, but never saw the light of day because both Roosevelt and Hitler died before the war was over. Roosevelt wanted the studies done to help him understand Hitler in future negotiations. I think that the CIA is doing that now, where they do psychological profiles of leaders, and I think they're pretty accurate. They're pretty clear. They really have a good picture. And what I base it on is everything he's written, everything he's said. I read Whitehouse.gov every day, or I did, watching and rewatching all of the different video tapes and listening to audio tapes of various press conferences, his broadcasts, and then reading things written about him, but most particularly the things that were written by his father and by his mother. She wrote two memoirs, and his father wrote one. And looking at old biographical data about him, on, for instance, published articles in the New York Times and interviews that he's had in various places over his career. And I think that I get a pretty good picture of him that way, and you can certainly start looking for patterns and noticing different things in his behavior and start trying to understand what they're about and then put them in the context of his family history and what it was like for him growing up.
Oh, are there any limitations to this methodology?
Yes, there are two very serious, three, I guess. One is that the most powerful tool in psychoanalytic understanding is transference, namely the feeling that the patient has towards you in the consulting room, and I don't get to have that. The second is direct observation, where I can see his reaction to things I say and notice things, and I can also notice my reaction to him, which is called countertransference. So that's the second thing. And the third limitation, I think, is that I'm more likely to be influenced by preconceptions of him. In other words, that I would think ill of him politically, or I would disagree with him. So I had to always be watching that to make sure that didn't influence me too much, and be able to write a more. And most people have said that, you know, some people from the left have said that it's too humane and too balanced a book. But when you get to know people, you get to know their humanity.
You've written in your book that Bush's behavior, I believe, strongly suggests some sort of an unconscious resentment toward our own servicemen, whose bravery and valor kind of puts his own wartime service record to shame. That's a tough statement. Can you explain it for us?
Well, it is a tough statement, and it was one of the hardest ones to really be. Really, it took me a while before I was willing to commit to making it. And basically, he is a person who had a hero for a father who was a war hero and was a superstar. Growing up, he was like a legend. And at Andover, his father's picture was all over the place when he arrived there at prep school when he was 15. And he always tried to be like his father in some ways, but was extremely rivalrous with him and had a great deal of great capacity to mock and have contempt for people that he also admired. And he was really conflicted about it. So one of the things that happened was he evaded the Army. In fact, not only that, he was in the Air Force Reserve getting in through a friend of his father's. And then he was AWOL from that reserve for quite a while and avoided even doing the required duty. But he was clearly not able to, in his own mind, be the kind of man his father was. I think that he has a great deal of mixed feelings towards servicemen, that he has a great deal of contempt and hatred for people who are far braver than he is. He's a person who is fundamentally not brave. In my experience, he can hold up a wanted dead or alive poster, but then avoid any kind of direct confrontation at press conferences. When he went to England, which was our staunchest ally, he would not face questions from Parliament, which would even be, many of them would be positive. He is afraid of direct confrontation, so I think that what he does is he expresses his both his wish for our servicemen to be heroes and at the same time his contempt for their ordinary bravery. He never, ever has asked anybody in his family to go into the service. His daughters have never volunteered or been pushed to help out where they could work in hospitals, do all kinds of things. They've never done anything. So I think that, and that his contempt also comes out in his refusal to go to the funerals of any of the servicemen. He really does not want to look at his own destructiveness. These are hard words, and tough words. And several people, which I didn't write in the book, parents of young soldiers who were killed, had happened to read the book and called me up about it and asked me if that they had never had this feeling until it happened with their own children, that they felt that there was something really different about them fighting, having his children fight for our country, having our children, rather their children, fight for our country, and following a president who they didn't feel really supported them. you can see evidence of it in his behavior. There is no support for them in terms of armor. There's no support for them in terms of backup. There's no support for them in terms of even clean water. There's extremely limited support and constantly insisting that they re-enlist. This isn't really to save money only, although it's very cheap. This is really evidence of a real destructive attitude towards our armed services. There's no request for Americans to sacrifice to really make an extra effort to help our servicemen overseas.
Yes.
It's just not there. And I really do think that he's fundamentally a very destructive person in this regard.
Well, I'm told that that's disturbing and interesting. I'm told that Bush has Saddam Hussein's pistol in a case, in a glass case in his office, and he likes to show it off to his visitors. And keeping in mind all of the negatives that have surfaced about the war in the last couple of years, what does showing off this gun tell you about this president?
Well, I am a Freudian. So it's obvious to most people in our culture that showing it off has to do with being able to brag about his phallic prowess, let's say. And that's one huge function of it, that he's both more powerful than his father and he's got this gun. But again, it also tells me very much in the same that is a lot of it is make-believe. He didn't get the pistol from Saddam Hussein. He has it. Somebody else got it. There's never been any kind of discussion of whether or not he would be able to ever argue fight with anybody directly. One of the things that is striking is that his waving around the gun is very similar, at least it seems to me, to his dressing up in military uniform and his the way he was on the U.S. Destroyer and where he was. There was an article about a month ago that was nicely titled "Dressed to Kill" with his picture on it. It was in Vanity Fair. I think one of the things about the gun is letting people know that he's powerful and that he's strong and that he is has defeated Saddam Hussein.
Wow, very interesting. You know, going back to what you said about his dad and his relationship, you know, it's well known, I think, with insiders in Washington that Bush 41 doesn't really support this war, never did, and that he thought it was a mistake. Do you think this president's insistence at going into Iraq and to be so closed-minded on the issue indicates a problem between him and his father, some sort of an issue with his son trying to prove something to his dad?
I think everything you said is exactly right on the money, except it's not proving something to his dad, is that he's trying to prove his father was wrong. It's not proving that he can do something, but it's trying to prove that his father was wrong in not going after Saddam, that his father was wrong in saying it was a mistake to go into Iraq, that a lot of his energy is not to prove something to his dad, but to prove that his father is, shall we say, full of it.
Oh, so not dad. I'm trying to get your I'm trying to get your approval here. I'm it's actually dad. I'm better than you.
Yes.
Oh,
and that you're full of it, and I have contempt for you. There's a he really attacks all kinds of law. He attacks treaties. He attacks everything, and that unconsciously, people who consistently attack the law and consistently attack treaties and consistently mock everything from the UN to Congress to the laws of having whatever the laws are, people who do that and constantly are comfortable with that are usually in a chronic struggle unconsciously with their fathers, men who do that, and that he is essentially wanting to defeat his father. It's not about wanting to prove something to his father to get his father's love. On the contrary, his father has actually been quite generous with his love over the years.
Well, a lot's been reported and written about the president's mother and how she ruled the roost in the family and you know the public perception. The average American thinks she's detached from reality or is just made of stone. Has that had an influence on this president?
I think it's had a deep influence, her detachment. And she combines detachment with a kind of laser-edged capacity to be cool and sarcastic verbally. Although she may have even been physically, she did apparently hit the kids some by his cousin. One of the things that I think about her detachment is so profound is that he is almost like a mockery of his mother. My thought is that he was left alone as a child in certain ways because she was detached. And there's a way in which I sense that he is identifying in a mocking way with her, and he is treating the servicemen and the rest of us the way he felt treated as a child, namely, I'm here, I'm not going to pay any attention to you. I'm the president, I'm your mother, I'm the strong person, but I talk a good game, but I'm not going to pay any attention to you. So there's a disconnect and a detachment that is very similar. You could see it in his eyes when he was briefed about the Katrina episode a couple weeks ago when those tapes were released. You could certainly see it in his eyes, how disconnected he was when the 9/11 news came, when he was in Florida. There's a way he disconnects. And in that sense, I think his mother had a very profound influence on him. In that, my guess is that anybody who has a detached parent would really hate it and do everything they could to get their attention. And, of course, to some extent, he did with her for a while and then gave up on it. But I think he treats us the way he felt treated.
Do you think his president has, I know we've all got some at least minor sadistic tendencies in us, but this guy is known to be, blowing up frogs and making fun of condemned prisoners and branding people with hot coat hanger wires when he was in college. Do these episodes show some sort of an abnormality beyond that of an average person?
I don't think so. I think that what's abnormal is he's not able to be in touch with his sadism or struggle with it or have a conflict about it. Lots of people have sadistic tendencies. People love watching prize fights on television. Kill the umpire is not an uncommon phrase I've heard and yelled. And certainly people watch 24 on television and all kinds of things like that that involve torture. But they're popular shows. I love 24. But what's different is that he is completely disconnected from his sadism and doesn't see it as being cruel in a certain way. And the goal in therapy is not, for instance, for me, when I work with people, is to help people recognize their sadism so they can do something about it. Like when you said, we're all a bit sadistic, right away that means you know something about yourself.
Sure.
He would never say that about himself.
Oh. Well,
the issue is not so much that he's more cruel, although I think it is more cruel to blow up frogs, and certainly to burn people in products with hot coat hangers. And he is definitely more sadistic than most people. I will take that back, although most of the people do that. But what's so striking is not only the degree of it, but his denial of it, and his denial of the impact of it.
We've heard it mentioned many, many times in the press and privately that Bush is often described as a dry drunk. Does that dovetail into any of this?
Well, one of the things about dry drunk is that, first of all, it's not a medical term. It's an AA term. And I have nothing against AA. In fact, I usually don't like to treat alcoholics unless they're also in some kind of a program, particularly AA. But dry drunk is not technically a medical term, but it is a very good description of certain characteristics, which is it means that he has the same characteristics as somebody who is drinking heavily, but who is not drinking, so therefore he behaves in certain ways that are similar. Impulsive rage, suspiciousness, the need to see the world in black and white, difficulty managing anxiety, so there's a great tendency to have to manage anxiety by completely controlling his environment. Those are some of the aspects that you see in people who are actively drinking, not taking responsibility, blaming other people for anything that goes wrong. I had a patient who was a, what we would call a dry drunk, who I was treating for 2 years. I wrote about it in the book. And I was so frustrated because he was blaming everybody, wife, kids, boss. And I finally said, have you ever done anything wrong? And he looked at me and he said, yes, hiring you. Well, that was pretty funny, and maybe it was his biggest mistake. It was striking how he couldn't acknowledge anything except in quips like that.
Yes, yes.
And I could see Bush doing the same thing.
There seems to be a general theme through the book. It seems to be the book seems to be about character and behavior patterns to take note of, not about diagnosis.
Yeah.
It seems to be kind of aimed at influencing people to think about his competence to maybe govern our country and his method of governing, rather than to put him in a certain category.
Exactly. It's not about diagnostic categories as best I can do, because, A, I don't even like making diagnoses except when I have to for insurance forms for patients, because I really like to get to know people. I mean, I can do it. I'm good at it even, but I don't like to do it if I don't have to do it. I'm much more interested in long-range patterns. One of the issues that has beset all of us in this country is that we have about a three-week memory span about events, so they go off the radar screen very quickly and we're always changing. And I think that we don't really take a longer view. We live in a much more digital society than an analog society where, you know, the hands of the clock go around. And I think that it's really important, looking at President Bush and looking at any of our politicians, to look for patterns of behavior. And that's what this book is about. And one of the clear patterns, again, is the one you mentioned of sadism. Another pattern is of comfort living outside the law and refusing to take responsibility from the time of his, you know, earliest times to just last week. There are patterns that you can start looking at, and those patterns together, for, in my opinion, make it really pretty clear that he is not competent to be president. He should not be president because he is not his. He's so focused on managing anxiety and staying safe and living outside the law that he really can't take seriously the problems that face us. Plus, he has to manage his emotions, and that's what alcohol did for him for a long time. The technical term for that is affect regulation, which means regulating his feelings. He's not really able to do that very well, so that's why he has to increase his exercise routine. Why he has to, in times of stress, he dissociates and disconnects and tunes out and splits his mind so he's not really feeling the full emotion of what's happening.
I guess I don't have to tell you that that what you're saying is not only interesting, but it's somewhat frightening to the average American to hear this.
I think it's very frightening. That's why I wrote the book, because I was so scared. I never felt frightened about a president. I felt frightened of presidents, and I felt frightened by them. And I've been really enraged at Johnson, Vietnam, or some of Reagan's Star Wars stuff, but I've never felt a question about their competence. And also, if you're not in touch with your sadism, you really are destructive towards the youth of America. I think he's actually destructive towards the whole country, and I don't think he's aware of it.
Oh my.
He likes breaking. And even when he made the comment last week about somebody asked him about how long our troops would be there, and he said that's for future presidents to decide, that was quite stunning to me.
I was shocked by that statement.
It's an example of avoiding responsibility, and it's an example of a child who makes a mess in their room and wants his mother to clean it up.
Mm.
He doesn't want to take responsibility for the mess.
Yes.
And I think that is very typical. And it is destructive because the room he's making a mess of is our nation.
That's right. That's right. Dr. Frank, I have so enjoyed this. Your book is absolutely wonderful. It's insightful. I know it's caused uproar, furor probably with people that very much involved
in the White House, for sure.
Yes, yes. But I want to thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
I know our listeners are loving this, and I appreciate it more than you could know. Dr. Justin Frank, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, what can I say after that? what can I say after that? I don't know. Have you read that book? You need to. That was a frightening story we just heard there by a man highly esteemed in his profession. You heard him say he was upset with Lyndon Johnson. Here's a man that really doesn't have a political axe to grind. He just saw what he saw and wrote a book about it. Not to further enrich himself, because he's not the kind of guy that needs that extra buck from a book, believe me. That is just a frightening, frightening story that we just heard there of a man who in no way whatsoever should be the president of the United States.
I found him very profoundly interesting. For those who were listening, had the opportunity to hear something that maybe we all thought in our minds, but now hearing it from the doctor justifies our thoughts. And for those who haven't listened, my goodness, they missed an opportunity of someone who knows what he's talking about. And it I was just in awe, and everything, all the questions that you asked him, Guy, and his answers were, oh, my God, this country has a president like this?
Yeah, well, it's something we're going to have to live with for a while. I hope we don't. I hope we can do something about it. Hey, we're gonna pause for a break right now, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. We have people waiting on the phone, I know, and we'll be back in just a moment. So fantastic when you pay with plastic. That's some friends from mine have a website called Billionaires for Bush. You might want to visit that. And they sent us some great stuff during the last election, and that's a new one out from those folks, the Billionaires for Bush. Go visit their website. It's pretty interesting. It really is. I think it looks good. 866-546-5254. That's 866-546-5254. We're going to go to the phones now, and I believe we've got Alice in Humboldt County, California. Hello, Alice.
Hi, Guy.
Well, hello.
I am convinced that this war is very profitable to some of them. That I believe is why we are over there.
Sure.
Halliburton and other French companies are receiving billions as they wipe out our treasury.
Follow the money.
Yep.
Follow the money. You can always follow the money. That's isn't it a shame that we as Americans have to think like that? I mean, isn't it just a shame?
Yes, it's a shame. It really is. We just have to hang in there.
Yeah, that's Alice. You've hit on it. We've got to hang in there. We've got to hang in there until we get things straightened out and
do everything we can.
We sure need to in this time around. That's why we just can't emphasize enough how terribly important this election is coming up to regain the House and hopefully the Senate. So many times people look at a midterm election like it's not a big deal, but it is a big deal this time.
Yes, it is.
I don't think we can take another 2 years of this man.
No, I tell you, I don't know how we could.
No, I don't either. Alice, good of you to call. Good to hear from you today. We thank you from the great state of...
keep up the good work.
Thank you, Alice.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, it's... I don't know. Another 2.75 years of this administration? How can we do that? How can we do it? I really mean that. I'm not sure we can stand it. I'm absolutely not... I'm in fear that the nation just can't take another 2.75 years of this administration. I don't see how we can. You know, stop and think about it. Over the last several months, especially over the last 2 or 3 months, it just gets worse and worse and worse every single day. Every single day, it just gets something bizarre, something off the wall comes out about them every single day. And now, you know, just yesterday or so, Sunday, we have this memo nailing down what we've all been saying all along. Man, I don't know. We are going up in the, I don't know whether it's a frozen north or right now or not. We're going to Karen in Alaska. Karen, is it frozen in Alaska? Here we go.
Warmer, it's about 12 above.
12 above. Well,
yeah.
Gee whiz.
Yeah, it's not below zero, so that's a big plus right there.
No, that's tank top and shorts weather.
There you go. I've still got about 4 feet of snow on the ground. But, yeah, I haven't had a chance to get out and start my gardening yet. But
where are you in Alaska, Karen?
In Fairbanks.
Okay.
Yeah, the absolute golden heart of the interior.
Yes.
Very red country, what can I tell you?
Been there. That's an interesting place, most definitely.
Well, I just wanted to let you know that I'm real glad to hear you back on the air and that your Farthest North fan never deserted you, of course. What do you think of Andrew Card just all of a sudden kind of, you know, making an exit?
You know, Andrew Card's probably the one guy in the inner sanctum of that Bush White House that I think may have any scruples. And to see him bailing out right now, and I could be wrong about that, but to see him bailing out right now really makes me wonder if they don't know something very, very serious is up with this new possible Fitzgerald indictment. I really have to wonder.
That is exactly where I was going. You know, Andrew Card, to me, he's the only one that really had any, I don't want to say intelligence or anything like that, because, you know, a lot of these people are not stupid.
Oh, no.
Maybe I'm dumb, and I'm not really thinking of integrity, because I don't think anybody associated with the Bush White House has any. I'm more thinking of pragmatic, you know, pragmatic.
Yes, yes.
He's the only one that had any sense. That said, you know, that has had any kind of restraint on the administration. And it just kind of it's almost scary that the good rats are deserting.
Yeah, yeah. I something's up. And, you know, they look so bad right now. I don't ever remember. You know, I think a few days before Nixon resigned, I don't remember our government looking this bad. I really don't. No.
I don't either, and you know, the Nixon administration was pretty scary, but, and you know, I don't want to say he was quite as pathological as Bush is, but, you know, the Nixon administration was scary, but there was still some restraint.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, right now, we have no restraint.
That's right.
That's what's terrifying. I'm sitting 90 miles from Mr. Bush's Star Wars, and, you know, I'm just wondering what's going to happen if somebody decides to push a button.
Yeah.
Nine
oh, yeah.
Miles.
And these are the kind of
things don't work.
These are the kind of people that you think might do it too.
Exactly.
I mean, they really are.
Exactly. especially after the doctor's talk. That was an excellent interview with him, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Frightening, wasn't it?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm not absolutely positive I'm going to sleep real well tonight, but, you know, it was great listening anyway.
I know the doctor isn't fond of, in fact, won't categorize Mr. Bush and won't diagnose him, but does the word sociopath come up? It does to me.
Exactly. Sociopath. The thing, and I just happened to mention this on a forum that I'm on, you know, I have thought for a long, long time that George Bush is pathological, at least.
Yeah.
Sociopath definitely hit my mind when you were talking to the doctor.
Yeah, I'll make a diagnosis if the doctor won't. I don't have any professional affiliation, so they can't take my license away. So I'll go ahead and do it.
Well, no doctor with any integrity at all would make a diagnosis not having actually seen the patient. But
you're wrong about that.
Bill
Frist makes diagnoses without seeing a patient.
Did you notice, though, that I used the word integrity?
You're way ahead of me. You're way ahead of me, Karen.
Mr. Frist the cat killer, what can I say?
Yeah, was it way back during the, oh, gosh, all of a sudden I'm having the poor gal that was, the Terri Schiavo affair.
Right.
That's when Bill Frist made his diagnosis over the telephone.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was
exactly. And I'm heading down to pick up Michael Schiavo's book today. As a matter of fact, I've had it on order, and they just called me and said it's here. So, you know, I think the guy went through enough. I really do.
I don't know of a lot of people that have been more wronged than he was by the government. The government treated him like he's dirt, you know, and all.
Well, the worst part about it is, I mean, what gives any government the right to say, you know, you can't pull your wife's plug even though she asked you to?
Right, right.
You know, that was the one case that made me literally go out, run to my lawyer, and get a living will.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people joined you on that. a lot. I happen to know one attorney in California told me he was extremely busy after that was over with, so.
I can imagine. I can definitely imagine.
Yeah.
Well, listen, guy, I just wanted to call in and let you know that, hey, we're still listening way up here, even if we're a little chilly.
All right. Well, Karen, it's great to hear from you from the great state of Alaska. Thanks so much for calling.
Anytime. I'll be listening.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ah, yes. From the great state of Alaska. I have been to Alaska, and actually took a motorcycle trip up there one time. And you're riding up the Alcan Highway. Back then, it was a dirt road. It was a stone road, and it was a good stone road. It was during the deal when they were doing the Alaskan pipeline. So I'm kind of dating myself a little bit. But here I was riding this Triumph motorcycle, my beloved Triumph Bonneville motorcycle. Still like to have that bike back. But I'm going up the Alcan Highway, and it was a stone road. It was about 1,200 miles of stone road, and the trucks would come flying at you, and you'd get off the road and hide behind a tree. Because the rocks would come flying at you and break your little motorcycle. So it was quite a trip, but awesome country. Biggest mosquitoes you ever see in your life. It's one of those deals on where the mosquitoes up in Alaska should have numbers on their wings. You know, they're that big. You'd ride about 5 miles during that time of year, and I had a windshield on the bike, and it would turn just absolutely black in no time. Couldn't even see out of it anymore. So you'd have to stop along the river and wash the windshield off a little bit. Well, we're going to go back to the phone. We're going to visit California once again, and we've got Dave on the line. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the show, Dave. Whoop, wrong button. Hello, Dave. Welcome to the show.
Guy, one of your biggest fans, and I much appreciate the interview with Dr. Franks there. I would say that we are certainly dealing with very, very serious character disorders on the part of this whole group of PNAC neocons there. They share. You know, it's unusual that this kind of people could buddy up together and bond. It would be not their nature to be trusting of one another, that they would be seeing each other only as there to be exploited.
I think you said the magic word right there. It's unusual that they would trust each other.
Right, right, right. And I would imagine now more it's going to start where you're going to see Rove giving up Cheney, and you're going to see each of them, I guess, as they're being indicted, saying, can I spill my guts and save myself?
Yeah. Well, Dave, you saw it. I saw it. A lot of people saw it. We saw these tendencies, these traits in these people. Well, what do you think it is that prevented 51 million voters? What prevented them from seeing it?
Well, I would say that a lot of them tune into the wrong station, and they're being told that they have superior morals, that they are a higher class of people because they know the truth because they listen to Rush and Fox. And it's nice to hear that, and you want to believe it. But I think it was nowhere near as many as the voting machine suggested it was. I dare say Gore and Kerry won by a pretty healthy, I'm sure. Gore won by 8 or 9 million votes, and I think Kerry won by about 20 million. These voting machines can play funny games with us.
Well, I know you're of the opinion they did. I'm of the opinion they did. I don't know the numbers, but there's little doubt in my mind that that actually the way it turned out, probably Al Gore would have been an incumbent running in the last election. He'd probably served two terms if things would have been fair, but they weren't. And
I think there's some logic that you can just ask yourself. Why did the GOP have this machine designed? Why does it not leave any record? Why does it have a modem? Why is it easily demonstrated that you can go into the machine by modem and change votes around? Why is it that in some small precincts, one voting machine deliver 100,000 votes to the GOP? We have to have a recount. There's only 250 voters in this precinct. Recount? What are you talking about? There's nothing to be recounted. There's nothing there, you know?
Yeah, they didn't take it seriously at all.
Why did they block all efforts in the Congress to bring these machines to be made verifiable? They just will not let anything like that be voted on. Why do you think that is?
Well,
it's pure logic. They plan to do it to us again.
Yeah, they do. I think you're absolutely right. They'll do it whenever they can. I'm sure they'll do it again. I am.
Guy, every contact you have with any congressman or senator, get them to take this as their highest priority. Say, get rid of these crooked voting machines. You know, I don't think they see it. I don't hear it from them.
I don't think they do either. I really, Dave, I think a lot of people think, you've heard the names, a bunch of crackpots. We don't, you know, conspiracy theorists and all that sort of thing. I know there are congressmen who know those voting machines were rigged. However, they're afraid to say so in public. I know that.
Well, you've got one, Rush Holt, who's actually been introducing bills on it. I do believe even Hillary did it. Howard Dean actually watched it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Bev Harris of Black Box Voting demonstrated how she could go in and change all the votes on an election in a matter of minutes.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
Guy, you do a wonderful thing, my friend. I'm looking forward to when you can get a guest, and if I can come up with a good one for you, I'll refer him to you.
Well, Dave, I thank you so much for calling today from the great state of California. Good to hear from you. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Guy.
Yeah, Dave from Eureka, California. Boy, it's pretty country up around Eureka, California. It really is some of the finest scenery that you'll find in all of that great state. And California, they can talk about California all they want to, about being liberal heaven and all that. Hey, they've got a Republican governor right now. I don't know how conservative he is, and kind of looks like he's making a mess of things, although I haven't heard much about old Arnold lately. I haven't heard much about him at all. There was a big uproar for a while, but it's all kind of died down, and who knows? Maybe he'll get to run again. Who knows? I do believe he had his sights set on something higher, though. And remains, you know, Orrin Hatch, I think we mentioned yesterday, Orrin Hatch from Utah brought up, tried to get some interest in a bill anyway to take away the requirement of having to be American-born in order to be elected president. I, for one, would never change that. I know. We're not giving everybody equal opportunity there, but there's just something about that I don't know. I think it's good that you got to be American born. So we got we've got another person affected by that, Jennifer Granholm, the governor of Michigan. She was born in Canada, and I think she's lived in this country. I could be wrong, but I think since she was a little girl. But she cannot be elected president of the United States. And believe me, she's a woman that is strong, powerful, very intelligent. that if she were American-born, they might just be talking about her as a candidate for the presidency. I'm not so sure I wouldn't go along with it. She's a smart cookie, just to say the least, and a good administrator. So, you know, it's bitten both parties, her on the Democratic side and Arnold on the Republican side. I got information from a relative today, from a cousin up in Columbus, Ohio, and sent me some information from the Columbus Dispatch. And it appears that the support for Mr. Bush is kind of disintegrating in Ohio. The lock they had on a lot of Republican voters up there is gradually falling away. Due in no small part, I'm sure, to the esteemed governor of Ohio, Bob Taft. Oh, boy. I don't know that anybody ever had a worse governor of their state than Bob Taft. It's you'd have to get pretty far down a bad governor. Even a lot of people in his, you know, his own party think he's been a miserable failure in Ohio. But Ohio is one of those states that mystified me during the last election. And of course, Dave brought up something there. I do think there were things that happened with voting machines in places like Columbus and Cleveland that probably threw that election. It was close, and probably threw it over to the Republican side. But still, Ohio is one of those states where the vote shouldn't have been close. And who knows, maybe it wasn't, but it shouldn't have been close. You got to all your blue-collar cities in Ohio up around Youngstown and Warren and Akron and Canton and Cleveland and all up there. I know the face of that state has changed a lot. A lot of those blue-collar jobs they're gone. And it's kind of the Rust Belt up there now. But, you know, good old Union territory. I would like to, in a show in the very near future, and we're doing a lot of research on this, would like to talk about immigration. And why do you think the Republicans are so reticent to do anything about the illegal immigration that's going on right now? Why do you think that? Could it be that this has been a nice tool for them over the years to get cheap labor? Could it be that it's been a nice tool for them over the years to get cheap labor to bust unions with? Could it be that this has been a nice tool over the years for them to get cheap labor to further reward their fat cat friends instead of labor going out to workers doing an honest day's work to put more money into the pockets of the stockholders and the shareholders and the fat cats in those companies? Is that why they're reticent to do anything about it? I think so. What do you say? You would accuse the Republicans of doing something so dastardly, allowing 11 million illegals in this country just so that they could make more money? Yes. Of course I would say that. But I think it's true. I'll never snow you, folks. I do think that's true. So, interesting. Very, very interesting. A lot of things in the news this week that I think made for an interesting week so far, and God knows where it's going to go from here with these new possible indictments coming up. But like I said, that's going to be a little while. But I found it interesting the other day, today, that you remember Bush giving that speech the other day about how he was so proud of the progress that's going on in Iraq. And particularly he mentioned a city called Tal Afar, an Iraqi town singled out as a success story for American and Iraqi forces. It was last night the scene of a suicide bombing that killed at least 40 people and wounded 20 others. This is the city that Mr. Bush said there was a lot of progress in, and it was safe and it was wonderful, you know, everything. Good news. Good news. And we have found out, and I'd like to know what you think about this. I know I'm appalled by it. In an apparent effort to mend his rocky relationship with members of the press, Bush has been holding informal off-the-record sessions with major news organizations over the last several days. Knight Ridder's Ron Hutchison said they were likely part of the outreach aimed at improving support for the Iraq War. Do you think it's a good idea for reporters to be called to the White House, to get an invitation to go to the White House, and have private, secret meetings with the President of the United States? I don't. Surely they realize why they're being asked to come there. I hope they realize it. And, of course, there's this little tidbit in the news today about the $28 billion possible revenue oil companies stand to gain over the next 5 years under an obscure provision in last year's giant energy bill that allows companies to avoid paying royalties on oil and gas produced in the Gulf of Mexico. The provision received almost no congressional debate, mainly because Congress was lazy and in part because the provision was misleadingly advertised as cost-free. And did you see that the White House has now withdrawn its nomination of David Sanborn to run the U.S. Maritime Administration? Lord over these ports. Is it because he was a former Dubai Ports World Executive? You think that could be it? And what about our administration's part in the case of Abdul Rahman, the Afghan man who faced execution for converting to Christianity? He was released from prison today. And they said he quickly vanished, apparently out of fear for his life. And Italy's foreign minister said he would ask his government to grant Abdul Rahman asylum. Now, what do you think? The Bush administration probably asked the Italians to do that. They got to be embarrassed about how this turned out about Abdul Rahman over here. To hear Mr. Bush talk about it, plant democracy in that great nation of Afghanistan. And now they want to kill a guy before he, since he changed over to be a Christian. I promised somebody I'd tell a joke today. And I've got a joke, so try and get one of these every day. My friend Dan always sends me these great jokes. Dick Cheney and George Bush were having breakfast at the White House, and the attractive waitress asked Cheney what he would like, and he replies, "I'd like a bowl of oatmeal and some fruit." "And what can I get for you, Mr. President?" Well, George replied with his trademark wink and smirk. "How about a quickie this morning?" "Why, Mr. President," the waitress exclaimed, "how rude. You're starting to act like Mr. Clinton, and you've only been in your second term of office for a year." As the waitress stormed away, Cheney leans over to Bush and whispers, "It's pronounced quiche." Good one, Dan. I like that. I do. I think that's a good one. Well, we've had a lot to talk about today. As usual, we've gone on and on and on. I meant what I said earlier in the day about now's the time. I think it is the time to tell this administration that they need to get themselves packing. I know a lot of people would help them pack their bags.